From the Witherspoon Concert Hall in Omaha's Joslyn Memorial, KIOS-FM proudly presents another program from the Uta Holly Lecture Series. We'll hear a talk given by Family Life columnist Lori Borgman, author of Pass the Faith, Nourishing Your Child's Soul in the Everyday Moments of Life, and I Was a Better Mother Before I Had Kids. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, October 18th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Uta Holly Girls Village, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now is today's speaker, Lori Borgman.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Being in Nebraska is a homecoming to me. I was born in Lincoln and lived there until I was 8 and a half. So I have aunts and uncles and cousins scattered across the state. And as a small child, I was taught to say, "Go Big Red," and load the state of Oklahoma. Although I'm not sure it's doing much good for you right now. People from Nebraska are always so kind and so courteous. And that is especially true of people from Omaha. Ever since I arrived, people keep asking, "How was your trip? Is everything okay? How was your trip?" They're very genuinely concerned, and I have to tell you, my trip was uneventful. But today, if you can board an airplane and get off the airplane and have an uneventful, boring trip, that's a very nice way to travel. The most exciting travel I have ever had in my life was this spring when I was invited to address a Spouses of Congress event in Washington, D.C., and my daughters, one in college and one in high school, were invited to go with me. So I told them, and they were very excited, and naturally, their first question was not, "Who will we see and where will we go," but, "What do we wear?" And their first suggestion was capris, and I said, "That's way too casual," and then they said something about sundresses with spaghetti straps, and I said, "Girls, that won't do. Think Barbara Bush without the pearls. This needs to be formal." I said, "I think both of you have some very conservative black dresses with little white trim." And one of them said, "That's fine, Mom. If that's what you want us to wear, the black and white dresses, we'll do that. But know this, your very eligible and available daughters are going to look like nuns." I said, "I don't have a problem with that, girls. I'll introduce you as Sister Mary Catherine and you as Sister Mary Elizabeth," which, of course, would make me Mother Superior. I have always wanted a title with power. So we stuffed the little dresses into carry-on suitcases and go to the airport, park in long-term parking, and ride the shuttle to the terminal. We get off. We're each carrying one little carry-on bag on wheels. When something bizarre happened, it has never happened to me before, two men materialize out of nowhere to help with our bags. Now, when I travel alone, I have spent 20 minutes trying to hoist a big bag up over the curb. I have been splashed by cars, ridiculed by babies in strollers, but no time have any men materialized out of nowhere to help me with my bag. We go through curbside check-in, and the agent calls over another agent to confirm whether one of my daughters hasn't changed her hairstyle from the one on her photo ID. At no time in the years when I have flown has anyone commented on my hairstyle. From there, one of the agents personally escorted us into the terminal to show us where to stand in line at the United counter. That has never, ever happened to me. And so I'm asking myself, why? Why might the airport be a sunnier, brighter place today? Why is it that traveling seems so wonderful today? I think, could it be because I'm traveling with the girls? Could it be that when I travel alone, I wear a boring black pantsuit, I carry a black purse, I'm so dull even my suitcase is black, and I sigh a lot at the airport? I look at the girls and I realize they smile a lot at the airport, and they wear pink. Even their suitcase is a pretty floral print. They carry cute little purses, and their skin fits. I knew why the airport was a wonderful place that day, because I was traveling with Barbie and Skipper. Well, to get here to you, I flew from Indianapolis to Kansas City, rolling my own bag through the airport, thank you very much. And then I drove from Kansas City to Omaha with my dad, who is cute, but not quite as cute as Barbie and Skipper. How was my trip? It was very nice. Thank you very much. As Sarah said, I am a humor newspaper columnist. My column goes out to many, many papers in the States and a handful in Canada. And I have to tell you, it is a difficult time to be a humor columnist. No matter what I write, I am sure to offend someone. The only person it's safe to poke fun at is myself, and then I write a few columns like that, and I get letters like these. Dear Lori, I am a family therapist and have been in practice for 20 years. Enclosed is my card. If I can ever be of help, please call. By way of background, you should also know that I have probably not been on more television talk shows than anyone else in your lecture series. I don't mean to brag, but it's just how it is. One of Rosie O'Donnell's producers called me a few years back. She had read a column online about disaster vacations we take. Our family has a knack for timing vacations with natural disasters. You may have pictures from family vacations of your kids with Minnie and Mickey. We have pictures of flood damage, forest fires in Florida, and a tornado in northern Indiana. She liked the column, and she wanted to know if I had pictures from these vacations, and of course I did, and would I be on the show? I said, sure. She called back a week later and said they had changed their mind. They had given my slot to a musical potty chair. Not long after that, a producer from the Roseanne Arnold show had read a column of mine online, and she called and wanted to know if I had any terrible birth stories that I'd like to come on the show and share. I said, you know, nothing with a lot of screaming and hemorrhaging comes to mind, but let me think on it. She said, well, reading from your bio, I see that you have three teenagers. That must be your worst nightmare come true. I paused and I said, you know, opening my front door and seeing Charlie Manson on the other side would be my worst nightmare come true, but my children are not a nightmare. She hung up and she never called back. My publicist sent books to the producers at The View. They called and did two pre-interviews by phone. And they got back to my publicist and they said that I wasn't controversial enough, that I was too nice. There's nothing to kill you in the television world like being too nice. And had I known that in advance, I would gladly have said some disparaging things about Barbara Walters and Meredith Vieira. Several weeks ago, a producer from The Larry Elder Show, which is a new talk show this fall, had emailed me that she'd read a column online about my girls borrowing a pair of pants from one another, and the one girl accidentally tore the pants and delivered this way over-the-top dramatic apology. And the producer said it reminded her of growing up with her sister, and she laughed hysterically. And then she said Larry was doing a show on helping siblings resolve their issues. Would the girls and I like to come on and resolve our issues on this television talk show? Whereupon I laughed hysterically. I told her, fortunately for me, but unfortunately for her, the girls were very close and did not have issues that needed to be solved on national television. I told the girls, and the youngest one was very disappointed. She said, Mom, I would have been more than glad to fake conflict if it would have launched a television career. I said, honey, I have a 1,000 failure rate, and I'm not about to tinker with it now. So like I said, it is truly a pleasure to be here. And I check backstage, there is no musical potty chair. I get to be here. The title of my first book is true. I was a better mother before I had kids, and I wish that you had known me then, because I was a different person. I was a thinner person. I was a more patient person. I had the patience of Job. I had the wisdom of Solomon, Dr. Dobson, Dr. Spock, Dr. Roseman, Dr. Seuss combined. I'd never babysat a kid overnight. I'd never rushed a gushing facial wound to the emergency room. And until I was 24 years old, I thought that Burton Ernie was one person. Burton was his first name and Ernie was his second name. But despite my lack of experience, I had a clear vision of what motherhood would be like. And at the center of my vision was a house with a front porch and a wooden screen door, and the house would continually be full of children running in and out, building forts in the backyard, studying bugs under magnifying glasses, making cookies, working on projects. And when my children grew tired, they wouldn't protest a common sense nap. The children in my vision would come to me and they'd say, Mom, we're tired. They'd say, Mom, we need a snack. Apple, banana, whole wheat muffin. No preservatives, please. And then the children in my vision would beg me to read them verses from Longfellow while they lie down to recharge their batteries. The children in my vision were cheerfully compliant. The children in my vision never talked back. They never stood in their high chairs. They never shoved peas up their nose. They never whacked off three pink peony bushes at the base with pruning shears. And the children in my vision never went door to door selling gravel to the neighbors for 50 cents a stone. Well, so much for fantasy. After having three children and a huge reality check, I realized my vision of motherhood was a Norman Rockwell vision, whereas reality comes with shades of Stephen King. Now, in all fairness, parts of the vision are there. We do live in a house. I don't know about you, but I wasn't quite sure what to expect when we were expecting our first child. Does anyone really know what they're getting in for when they become a parent? I was never sure what to expect, no matter what age they've been. And you would think for a writer with imagination, I might be better at imagining the future, but I've always been bad. I couldn't imagine what it would be like to have a newborn. I thought that all newborns were a little homely. They looked like E.T. and they came in one standard model, Perma-Wet. Tell me that wasn't reason for concern. Well, our baby arrived, and I discovered that newborns came with a whole bag of tricks, the way they bat those saucer eyes and squeeze onto your pinky like there's no tomorrow and coo, that wonderful coo that you wanted to find a volume knob and turn it up loud. You felt blessed to have spit up on your shoulder and the scent of baby wipes on your hands. I realized infants were manageable. Then I looked at toddlers, and I thought, you know, those little people look nasty. Putting everything in their mouths, trying to open the cupboards and get at the poison under the sink, splashing in the toilet, swinging the cat by the tail. You can't take your eyes off those people for a minute. Toddlerhood, that can't be good. And then we had toddlers, and I realized they came with peanut butter kisses and smiles that could light up a room and dandelion bouquets and were so adorable when they dropped their fat little bottom in your lap and said, "Hold me, Mama, hold me." Toddlers were terrific. Yes, it was the preschool crowd that spelled trouble. Loud, pushy, stingy with their matchbox cars and territorial and picky over whether their sandwiches were cut into a rectangle or a triangle. I discovered preschoolers weren't half bad. They were curious and observant, and they loved to sing in the car, and they had an appetite for learning. Elementary kids were the ones that would be trouble. I'd seen them down at the bus stop on the corner. What I wouldn't give for an x-ray machine to see what they had in those book bags. Well, elementary kids turned out to be a blast. Middle school, that would be the hill on which we'd die. Don't kid me, I'd heard the talk. You don't teach middle school kids unless you have a calling for pain. They were awkward and gangly and in the throes of puberty. How would we survive? I'll tell you how we survived, with a smile. One of the best-kept secrets about middle school kids is their sense of humor. What other group would find delicious entertainment by going to the payphone at lunchtime, calling 1-800-PHONICS and saying, "My name Bob, me learn read"? Middle school kids were great. It was high school that was really intimidating, full-fledged teenagers. Did we want to go there? And it is true. There are days you bang your head against the wall when you have teenagers because it feels so good when you quit. But by and large, teenagers are pretty cool. They're great technical support right under your roof. They know the entire layout of the mall, including the food court. They know every station on the television and the radio. They're the only people in the world you can feed frozen pizza to 3 days in a row and have them thank you for it. Well, each stage has been richer and better than the stage before, more interesting, more stimulating, but I still wonder what's ahead. We have a wedding in the works next spring. Will I really be able to be the mother of the groom? I've heard there are just two rules: wear beige and keep your mouth shut. I'm telling you, I'm worried. I'm really worried. And what will it be like to go visit your married children? I mean, should I pack some food in my suitcase just in case she's a health food nut? I don't know. And what will it be like to have grandchildren? Will I be as nutty about them as some of you? I hope so. It looks like a lot of fun. Well, being that we still have one teenager and two early something 20s, like so many families, we are susceptible to a communication gap But if you use that term, communication gap, kids will look at you like you have three eyeballs. You may have heard the commercial, people judge you by the words you use. That is very true of young adults. My husband, I don't know why, but he recently used the word commode. Commode, the kids said. You're kidding, Dad. Commode. They said, do you know how old that word makes you sound? I don't know, Dad. It sounds like you're 50. The man is 52. Well, in addition to the word commode, he recently used another word that sent them into hysterics. We were talking about a co-ed dorm at my son's college, and my husband said, so theoretically, you could walk out of your dorm room, go into the hallway, and see a young lady in a negligee. There was a three-second delay while they processed the word negligee, and then they exploded in laughter. Nobody uses that word anymore. And who knows how many times we've dated ourselves like dinosaurs by using outdated words like lavatory, trousers, and icebox. It's not easy communicating with the family today. It's not easy communicating with the husband. We have been married 27 years, but it pains me to tell you there have been times during that 27 years of bliss when my communication has been so misconstrued that I have been accused of nagging. It hurts, ladies, doesn't it? It really, really does. I coincidentally clear my throat at the same moment he is emptying an entire bottle of ranch salad dressing on two lettuce leaves, and he says, I'm nagging. I'm not nagging. I just had a frog. We are driving down the road. I instinctively slam my foot on my imaginary brake on the passenger side of the car because he's tailgating, and he says, I'm nagging. I'm not nagging. I may whip out a cell phone and call the state trooper's office to report his license, but I am not nagging. I may happen to mention something about a leaky faucet in the bathroom. I may put 9 bright yellow post-its on the refrigerator door. I may put hardware to fix the leaky faucet under his pillow at night. He says, I'm nagging. I'm not nagging. Women don't nag. Women simply remind. Can I have some agreement? We all have such different styles of communication. It's a wonder any of us ever communicate at all. My husband and I have also had some communication problems on the subject of purses. He will tell you that I am the Imelda Marcos of purses. He will tell you that I own 450 purses, one for each day of the year and 2 for major holidays, including Groundhog Day. That is so not true. I only own, you know what, it's not important how many purses I own. But if I told you, you'd say, Lori, that's not enough. When you're through here, let's go shopping. Let's buy you some purses. Well, why does he think I'm the Imelda Marcos of purses? Because I let him. In a rare moment of department store togetherness, and we do not espouse, and camera, his car keys, his running shoes, and the blade to the lawnmower. You would think the man never heard the cliche, never bite the handbag that totes you. Men should pay close attention to women's purses because you can tell a lot about a woman by the handbag she carries. A female who carries one of those teeny tiny purses, no bigger than a slice of sandwich bread, is packing nothing more than 1 lipstick, 1 credit card, and 1 eyeliner pencil. She is usually very young, very thin, and very rich. I don't like her. Women who carry mid-sized shoulder bags are light years beyond that minimalist thing. They are packing coupon folders, bills to be mailed, bundles of punch cards, buy 12 loaves, get the 13th free. This is the purse of a survivalist. It is usually the purse of a woman with children. She is the designated pack horse for the family, be it a trip to the library or vacation to the Smokies. Her purse warehouses sunblock, stamps for postcards, manicure supplies, Tylenol, antibacterial hand gel, dried fruit snacks, and crackers wrapped in cellophane. This is the woman and the purse to approach in case of medical emergency or hunger. The third type of woman who carries an enormous purse resembling a bowling bag or a backpack is one of three types. She's either a young mother trying to disguise the fact that it's a diaper bag, or she is a woman to whom the phrase travel light has absolutely no meaning, or she is a grandmother who simply needs a little extra space for all those 8x10s of the grandkids she carries around. To know a purse is to know a woman. There are so many challenges that come with being a family. I think one of the biggest challenges is the difficulty of travel, especially when your children are young. If you read any of the parenting books, you'll find that the experts make it sound like children sleep a lot in the car. The experts make it sound like children will be entertained by alphabetizing license plates of passing motorists. We didn't get kids like those, did you? You know who makes traveling look easy? Retirees. We used to call my parents the Minutemen. You could call them day or night, and in 90 seconds, they would have the car loaded with the hostess gift and their cash that they hide in the deep freeze that everybody knows about. Now, I also know that not all retirees are like that. My father-in-law doesn't back the car out of the garage until he's checked the Weather Channel 16 times. And heaven forbid he has to use the restroom because he'll have to check it again. Because there's one thing he's learned, you can never underestimate the speed of a low front stalled over Montana. Well, I would like to share with you a traveling technique that worked pretty well for us when our kids were quite a bit younger. I believe the key to successful automobile travel with children, and I define successful as returning home with the same number of children you left with, is to remember this. Kids respect a stranger in uniform, which is why I would find it helpful to put on an old blonde wig, a navy blue blazer, and a pair of those United Airlines junior pilot wings. Then I'd buckle the kids in place, I'd lower my voice, and I'd say, "Hi, I'm Stacy, and I'll be your hostess today. Please be informed that maternal regulations forbid the transport of concealed rodents, reptiles, rocks, and all chocolate that melts in your hand, not in your mouth. All carry-on luggage, including Legos and Barbie accessories, must be stored under your seat until the time of takeoff. Our estimated time of arrival will fluctuate wildly depending on the stability of the interpersonal relationships within the vehicle. We hope you enjoy your trip." And then with one of those big fake frozen smiles and my fingers making graceful V's, I would point out the nearest windows in the event of motion sickness that resulted in projectile vomiting. And you know, it wasn't a bad routine. It kind of mesmerized them a while, and I'd hear them in the back seat chatting back and forth. Will she be back with a beverage cart or won't she be back with a beverage cart? But once they realized that the turbulence was from chuck holes and we were not airborne, I don't have to tell you, things can turn ugly pretty fast. The feats a woman under stress can perform at a 30-second stoplight are truly amazing. I'd like to share with you my personal best. I threw the gear shift into park because the crisis was triggered by a gagging sound making by the baby in the middle seat. I spiral vaulted into the middle seat, picked a piece of Easter egg grass off her tongue that was triggering her gag reflex. From there, I did a double vault on into the back seat where I loosened my son's grip on a shock of his sister's blonde hair. I applied pressure to a superficial scalp wound while threatening him with the possibility of an all-broccoli diet and finishing the trip strapped to the luggage rack. All that accomplished, within a cool 27 seconds, I spiraled back into the front seat where I put my seatbelt on and put the pedal to the metal as the light turned green. I glanced in my rearview mirror, and the driver behind me was cheering wildly and waving a card that said 9.7. Well, challenges grow as your children grow, and the older they get, it seems the greatest challenge is not to embarrass them. My kids have been helpful. They've given me a list of things I should not do to embarrass them, and so far it's only included three things. One, Mom should not use outdated phrases like, "That's what I'm talking about." They said that pretending to be hip is not funny. Two, Mom should not stand at the doorway every time someone leaves, wave, and yell, "Make good choices." That's not funny either. Three, Mom should not wave at cars that look vaguely familiar, even though she really can't see who's inside, because it might be someone she knows. That is just embarrassing. As you can tell, I have a full plate to handle. And now they've added a fourth thing I should not do, karaoke. Oh, naturally, the kids were a little mortified when they found out the husband and I had done karaoke in public. "What were you thinking?" my interrogator wailed. "Well, we were at this party, and they had a party tent, and they had those party twinkle lights on the ficus trees, and someone yelled, 'Karaoke!' And your dad said, 'Okay, let's go,' and he grabbed me by the hand, and honey, I thought he was teasing, so I got up out of my seat, but he wasn't teasing, he was for real." She said, "Why didn't you call home?" You've told us if a party ever gets out of control to call home. Any one of us kids would have come to pick you up. Oh, honey, it was just one little Sonny and Cher song. I mean, how hard could it be to do I Got You, Babe? She said it was terrible, wasn't it? I said terrible's kind of a strong word. We prefer to think we simply stylized it by singing off beat and off key and different verses at the same time. She said, how will we kids ever show our faces again? Oh, honey, you know, at first I had karaoke remorse, too. But then we realized we set the bar so low that the party really took off. Nobody was afraid to go after we'd gone. I said, and you know what? Maybe the singing part was awful, but a lot of singers are awful today, and they're millionaires. It's not about singing. It's about your moves. Oh, Mom, you had moves? Yeah, I said, you know how Cher always throws that microphone into the air and then catches it? I said, I did that. I probably did it 100 times because it was the only move I had, but I had moves. She said, I almost wished I could have seen it. I said, you can. They videotaped it. Oh, so maybe we embarrass them. They'll live. We're still learning about each next stage of life. How to age. I think Betty Davis is the one who said, aging is not for sissies. Aging is an art, isn't it? Naturally, there are health issues that come with age, but even health problems don't seem as bad as they used to. I ask you, have you ever seen so many happy, sick people in your life? They're in the magazines, they're on the television, they're popping up on websites. They suffer from acid reflux, rotten cholesterol counts, and social anxiety disorders, but they couldn't be happier if Ed McMahon was at the front door with a big fat paycheck. You know, one of my favorite guys in pain is the older gentleman with bad knees. He hobbles away to the doctor. He comes back a few seconds later, and he pulls a pill bottle out of his pocket. And I kid you not, 4 seconds later, he and his wife are dancing in their living room. It has been ages since my husband and I danced in the living room. You know, I'm thinking about getting a bottle of those pills. The other day, I was on my computer and a pop-up ad appeared. It was Debbie Reynolds speaking to me about overactive bladder. And you know, Debbie had such an upbeat, happy, cheerful, singing in the rain attitude about overactive bladder that it made me sorry I wasn't part of the club. I mean, I got up and went to the bathroom even though I didn't have to. And I am also very fond of the older woman who suffers joint pain, and she's doing some kind of slow motion martial arts in a public park. Now, what amazes me is that she's well over 60 and she's wearing spandex. I don't know anyone over 35 who wears spandex in public. The ad says the drug is for joint stiffness, but I'm thinking it must also do something remarkable for courage. People on prescription drugs are dancing, shopping, touring museums, going to off-Broadway shows. They are cruising the interstate in cool convertibles. Aging has never looked more fun. Well, among my immediate role models for aging, of course, would be my family. A while back, my mother mailed me 2 newspaper clippings with a Post-it stuck to the front of them. The first clipping told the story of a woman in England who left her mother lying on the floor of their home for a week, even vacuuming around her because mother, quote, often collapsed and remained on the floor for several days. The second clipping was a story about a man who barricaded his 92-year-old grandmother in the basement and would toss her sandwiches. On the pink floral Post-it note my mother had attached, she had written, "What are your plans for us?" My mother's dark sense of humor is what made her such a survivor. When we gave my mom one of those grandma necklaces a few years back, and you know what I mean, the chain with the figurines, we had no idea that she would attempt to set a trend. Mom wore the necklace often and said she loved keeping the grandchildren close to her heart. The thing was, you never knew if all 5 grandchildren would be close to her heart, or maybe only 4 or 3 would be close to her heart. I see one of the boys is missing, Mom. What happened? Your brother's youngest was sassy. I took him off the necklace. Well, Mom wouldn't actually take a grandkid completely off the necklace, but if one of them got cheeky, she'd take the figurine and zip it around back, you know, under her collar where it was all hot and stuffy. A short while later, another figurine was gone, and I said, "Who's missing now, Mom?" She said, "Your son. He made a comment about the varicose veins in my legs because I'm wearing shorts." When he straightens out, I'll put him back with the others. Well, Mom loved her grandkids more than life itself, but one day she went on record saying that if any of them got a bizarre tattoo or a weird piercing, she would take them off the necklace and put them face down in her jewelry drawer, and they would not rejoin the necklace until the piercing had grown shut or the tattoo had been removed. Now, I think there's something sad about a grandma necklace with no kids on it. But who's to say a plain gold chain can't be attractive, too? My mom died quite suddenly this summer, and I am so thankful for her example, her legacy, and the many, many wonderful memories she left behind. That woman left her fingerprints everywhere, and I know it was by design. My parents have been excellent role models for living and aging. My husband's parents have been good role models too. They married quite later in life and didn't begin their family till they were in their 40s. We lost my mother-in-law nearly 6 years ago to Alzheimer's. A year after she died, we began making suggestions to my father-in-law that maybe he consider selling the place in Ohio. We suggested he might even move closer to us, you know, doing what middle-aged grown kids do best, trying to boss their elderly parents around. Well, at least we hoped he'd be open to our suggestion to ease off some of the bacon and sausage and eat a few more fruits and vegetables. I thought we threw out a multitude of good plans, and he ignored them all. He waited till the entire family was together, and he announced that after serious thought, he had made a plan of his own. His plan was to buy a brand new convertible. He'd always wanted one, and he thought that age 87 was as good a time as any. We took turns staggering to the bathroom, splashing cold water on our faces. "Be practical," my sister-in-law wailed. "Practical?" He pointed out he hadn't exactly been living the lifestyle of the rich and famous. He was still on that small Ohio acreage in the old farmhouse that had been in the family for a century. He saved empty margarine tubs. He rarely bought more than 3 green bananas at a time, and he always shopped with coupons. He'd lived a lifetime of practical shoes, practical station wagons, practical sedans. "Please, please be practical," the throng continued wailing. He tuned out the caterwauling, and he began thinking to himself, thinking over and over, and the thought grew clearer. Chevy Cavalier. Chevy Cavalier with cruise control. White would be his first choice, and if they didn't have white, maybe blue. Actually, it was more of an indigo, according to the color brochures he'd hidden under the stack of Reader's Digest and National Geographic's on the coffee table. "It's not safe," my sister-in-law said. "How practical is it to buy a convertible and have it stolen?" said my brother-in-law. "Is that what you want?" Well, the old man thought for our combined intelligence and college educations, at least one of us would have heard of that anti-theft device called the club. Of course he wouldn't want his new convertible stolen. He didn't want his hip broken either, but that didn't mean he stayed in bed all day. "Oh, how much would you even drive it?" demanded another caring soul. "Oh, probably just during nice weather," he said patiently. Then again, maybe he'd pick up Marvin and Virginia and Helen, and they'd loop Dayton with the top down and the radio blaring in the middle of December with icy snowflakes stinging their cheeks. Maybe he'd drive it every day of the year, half an hour before sunset, just to see the sky fade to orange and feel the wind ripple through every strand of white hair he had left. "This needs a lot of thought, doesn't it?" said a caring voice in that voice that kindergarten teachers use to remind children to wash their hands after using the potty. He nodded his head and agreed we were right. It did require a lot of thought. Which is why, the next morning, he went to a different dealership on the west end of town. It was a far larger dealership, which would mean a better price. After all, it would be the practical thing to do. And my mother wanted to know what plans we had for hyperactive grandparents with more energy than most teenagers. What plans did we have for my father-in-law, who this August turned 93 and has a sharp tack memory and an even sharper convertible? I have an obituary at home on my desk that I clipped out of the paper and I always meant to send to my mom, and I figured, why not? She sends me dark stuff. I could send her dark stuff, and that's just how the relationship was. The obituary is for a woman I never met, never heard of. Her name was Ida Davidoff. I guess she was somewhat famous that her obit was in the paper. It said when her four children grew up, she had a lovely depression about her empty nest. Then she went back to college and earned a doctorate at age 57 in marital and family counseling. When arthritis made it difficult to stoop over and tend her garden, she planted wildflowers and raised boxes. When her fingers got too stiff to play piano, she took voice lessons. Ida Fisher Davidoff died May 11th in New Canaan, Connecticut, where until recently she had baked her own bread, swum nude in her pool, and was always thinking ahead. She was 97. She had no illusions about the vagaries of old age, describing her health as superb, considering. She told one interviewer, "If you wake up after 65 and you feel no Quaker pain, you're dead." She said, "I live as if I'm going to live a long time. I'm planting bulbs, putting in shrubs that will take years to grow. Why deprive yourself of even an hour of beauty because you don't know how long you'll be around to enjoy it?" She said there are four categories to life: babyhood, childhood, middle age, and gee, you look wonderful. She was survived by a son, 7 grandchildren, and 9 great-grandchildren. Isn't that delightful? With age comes perspective. With age comes confidence, and with age comes wisdom. Think back to when you were a teenage girl. I know you men can't do that, but you ladies, think back. When you were about 14, what was the most important thing to you? Love, loving and being loved. You first realize life is about love when you fall under the spell of your first crush. This coincidentally happens at the same time you fall under the spell of hormones. Both of these occurrences happen around the time of pre-algebra and acne creams. The event can best be described as a euphoria that fluctuates between nausea and nervousness. The first time I fell deeply in love was in 8th grade. I never told the boy that I loved him, but I didn't have to. Of course, he never told me that he loved me, but he didn't have to either. I did the talking for both of us in my head. I was so in love and so 14 that I found an empty cardboard box and I wrote "love" on the side of it with a red magic marker and big puffy cloud-like letters, and I hid it at the back of my bedroom closet. Notebook paper, pencil stubs, ball cap pens, anything that this boy touched was routinely deposited into my love box. The boy I loved came over to my house a few times. Now, cynics might think he came to see my brother or go fishing in the creek, but I knew why he was there. In stolen moments alone together, he would clear his throat, look at me, and ask for a drink of water. I knew that love caused dehydration. Once when he dropped by, half of our neighborhood was in the backyard having homemade ice cream and fresh strawberries. My mother fixed him a big bowl, he polished it off, and he asked for seconds. I was sure the boy I loved kept eating just to be near me. One day, my mother was cleaning the house, and she stumbled upon the love box at the back of my closet. "What's this?" she exclaimed. "I wondered where my drinking glasses were going. These are my good spoons. Is this an ice cream bowl in here?" My mother began to mutter unintelligibly. This happened a lot when I was 14. How could I explain the love box, to someone who was married and had kids? How could I explain love to someone who is always busy doing laundry, fixing meals, sorting mail, and going to work? Well, time passed, and I found myself married with kids and from time to time muttering unintelligibly. I am forever busy doing laundry, sorting mail, working at the computer. In the roll-top desk next to the computer is a drawer stuffed with mementos: hospital bracelets from when the kids were born, rose petals, handwritten notes, snapshots, a few ticket stubs. No spoons or ice cream bowls, but you might say it's a love box of another sort. When I remember that first love box, I always smile. I smile because I was crazy, because I didn't think a mother could understand love. But I also smile because I got it half right. Even at 14, I knew that love is what we live for. Loving and being loved yields a fullness of heart and a sweetness of soul that gives meaning and purpose to life. Love is what matters most at 14 and far beyond. It's what lasts for eternity. Faith, hope, and love, the greatest of these is love. Loving God, loving others, receiving love in return, a big concept expressed in a very little word. It's true, I'm sure. What was it on 9/11 that people were saying into cell phones from burning towers and doomed airplanes? The same three words over and over. I love you, I love you, I love you. The language of love is simple because the language of love is big, and big ideas are best conveyed in simple words. Families are forever changing. To me, they're like a creation of art on an open canvas, but that canvas continually unrolls and the picture changes. It grows, it expands, it's colored by births and deaths, weddings, divorce, graduations, new jobs, new neighbors, cross-country moves, and tearful goodbyes. Family, it's where we learn love, but as families, we're all just a little bit quirky. When we're apart, we can't wait for time together, and when we're together, we start thinking about time apart. You know, most every family is called to tread deep water from time to time, be it health problems, job changes, a kid pushing the envelope real hard. It's those things that add up and put a tightness in your chest and sometimes keep you awake between 2 and 3. No family is a downhill slide, but working hard, giving it our best shot to maintain a family, maintain relationships, cultivating a love for God and a love for one another is worth the effort. I've learned a lot by being in a family. And a couple of years ago, I was scraping around for an idea for a Mother's Day column, and I thought, maybe it's time to turn it around. Maybe I'm the one that should be sending the card and writing the note, thanking the kids for all the things I've learned from them. So I wrote them a letter, and in closing, I'd like to share that with you. Dear kids, I was thinking of the many things I've learned by being your mom, and I wanted to say thanks. As infants, you taught me flexibility. Had it not been for having babies, I never would have discovered that a woman can make it through a day on only 3 hours of sleep, half a pack of graham crackers, and a 20-second shower at 4 in the afternoon. As toddlers, you taught me the wonders of the human immune system. Your dirty faces and sticky hands were proof that the human race could survive germ warfare. Spit in a Kleenex may not have earned the good housekeeping seal of approval, but you taught me how to improvise. I also learned I would not die handling locust shells and earthworms, and that the picnic wasn't over just because someone slapped a frog down on the table right next to the carrot sticks. You taught me that a mother who can keep a car on the highway when 3 kids are fighting like cats and dogs in the back seat is a woman who can focus. You taught me I did have the patience to do French braids and to decorate a birthday cake with 500 stars squeezed one at a time from the tip of a frosting tube. I learned empathy when you struggled in school, humility when you were the kid who drove the soccer ball downfield for the opposing team, and compassion when you had your leg in a cast 3 times in 5 years. You taught me to sharpen my reflexes when you learned to ride a bike, and again when you learned to drive a car. I learned to keep a sense of humor when you said, "Why make the bed if I'm just going to sleep in it again?" You taught me about logic when you demanded a pony and said you'd take care of it. You taught me about the speed of time when you announced I should never again buy socks with pictures on them because those were for babies. You taught me about the speed of time when you got your first job, when you appeared for your first date radiating beauty with upswept hair wearing a long, pretty dress. Without you, I never would have learned a million things to do with an empty cardboard refrigerator box, the joy of draping a bedspread over kitchen chairs, or felt my heart skip a beat as I walked through a parking lot and felt an adolescent still willing to slip a hand into mine. Without you, I would not have learned the grace and art of fly fishing, the nuances of bird calls or the names of the constellations. Without you, I would not have experienced the terror of whitewater rafting, the heart palpitations that come from playing basketball and inline skates, or the bone-chilling terror of picking up the phone and hearing, "Mom, there's been a little accident." True, I was often unwilling to learn, but that never stopped one of you from teaching. The experts don't write about these kinds of things in the books, and they certainly don't teach these survival skills in school. If I had to learn them from someone, I'm glad it was from you. Love, Mom. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Uta Hawley Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by Family Life columnist Lori Borgman, author of Pass the Faith, Nourishing Your Child's Soul in the Everyday Moments of Life, and I Was a Better Mother Before I Had Kids. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, October 18, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Greg Petler and Randy Figura for their help in the recording of this program. Special thanks also to Tracy Wells for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture in the series will be Monday morning, November 8th at 11 o'clock. The guest speaker will be humorist Bob Farmer, speaking about The Farmer's Almanac. If you'd like to attend this or other lectures in the series, call the Utihaly Girls Village at 453-0803. Tickets for this lecture will be available at the door the day of the event. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.